Greetings and salutations, friends, and welcome back to The Arcade. We are your video game podcast here, back with you for the week of Friday, November 29th of the year 2019. How is it going, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages? I am Mike the Legend, who is back with you once again here after we were away last week. We apologize for that once again, as life got in the way, as it is wont to sometimes do, but we are back with you once again, and that's really all that matters.
Indeed, and this week I am Dennis, the man who is winding down the last days of Movember in anticipation of Decembeard.
Ooh, Decembeard.
Yes, which is really just me not so subtly saying I'm going to be growing my beard back.
Good, good. I was concerned. Maybe with the Movember, maybe you enjoyed the clean-shaven approach.
I mean, it was, you know, I feel like it's a good thing to do every now and then when you normally don't do it. You know, it's a good thing to kind of clean your face up for a while and
let it breathe.
Let it breathe for a while. But, if you normally have a beard, it's weird to not have a beard.
You go touch your face and like, oh yeah, yeah, there's nothing there. It's just skin.
It's like, oh, what the?
Where's the layer of bristle that I've become so accustomed to?
Also, the whole thing of like, cause I'm keeping like the mustache groomed, which by the way, I'm glad to say that I totally smashed my goal.
Excellent. Yes, so I think we should back up for a minute and say that you were participating in Movember, as we mentioned on the arcade episode from the start of November.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we had a link to it on our website, thearcadeshow.com, where, you know, you can see all sorts of stuff pertaining to this show. But I set my goal, like, I hadn't done this technically before. Like, you know, I grew a mustache during November a couple of times, but I never officially signed up for the Movember website because I was like, well, whatever. But this time I'm like, you know what? I'll do it. I mean, it's a good cause and whatever. And then, you know, joining the work team, it's kind of like a weird competitive thing kicks in. I'm like, oh, I know people with money. Yeah, people are going to donate to me just for growing a stupid mustache. Okay, fine. It's coming okay. Like, I mean, I want to toot my own horn, but I can grow some facial hair. So,
well, with the way you have it, with the classic handlebar style mustache,
oh yeah,
it looks like you should be wearing a jean jacket at all times with band patches on it.
Oh yeah, and I should have a mullet probably as well.
Yes,
but anyway,
big old Motorhead patch right across your back shoulders.
Yeah, but I'm not doing that, obviously, but. But yeah, so I set the goal for $200 and then I met my goal in, I think it was 35 minutes of posting on Facebook. I was like, oh, okay. And that just kept going. And now I'm at just over $500, which is a pretty good feeling to be like, oh, I'm the top fundraiser for the team. There's like 30 people competing, not competing, but like being on the team, but participating in the team. And it's just like, just to see my face sitting the top there. It's like, that's pretty fun.
Yes, your very intense looking face.
Yes.
Which is one thing I noticed when I pulled up your page, just to check in on your campaign and see, oh, that you surpassed your goal. Also, why are you so intense staring into the camera?
Well, you know,
it's a film strip. It seems like you can scroll through a couple of photos. The first two or three are just intense Dennis and then regular Dennis.
Well, I have a mustache and I'm clearly not happy about it. So
that explains a lot. Thank you for answering my query.
I'm using contempt to fuel my fundraising campaign. So,
and it's worked.
Yeah, it's clearly worked. It's been a winning strategy, I think. I'm going to use it every year.
Straight to the top every year.
Yes.
In your Movember fundraising campaign. And there's just a few days left, depending on when people are listening to this episode. If you're getting it right when it's released, you have until the end of November to still contribute to Dennis's campaign. If you look in the show notes for this episode, we'll still put the link back up in there for you to click through. And if nothing else, just gaze upon Dennis's visage and just see how intense he really is with the contempt for his mustache.
Yes, exactly.
Excellent. Well, if your campaign even goes no further than where it is, congratulations on surpassing everyone else on the team and being the top fundraiser at work and having bragging rights over everyone else.
Yes, I'm knocking on this wood right now because I want to make sure that anything could happen in, like, you know, the just before the buzzer moments. You know, yeah, someone might swoop in with a $200 donation. And it's like, well, you win. Fine. Can't compete with that. but, you know.
Before that, before, as of the moment.
As of this moment, and as of most of the month, you know, it's like, yep, top of that list. Oh, yeah.
In the lead, comfortably coasting.
Absolutely.
Like a champion does.
I've done my part. How about all the rest of you? Just being a real asshole about it. No, I won't do
that. And then if people remind you, it's for charity.
Yes. And then I go, I don't give a shit. Come on.
I'm in it to win it. Win it for charity.
Yeah. All the more reason to win this thing. Anyways, yeah.
You do everything intense, don't you?
Apparently.
You have two gears, regular and intense.
Yes, regular and then off the rails. Because the gears are also made for a train, apparently.
No reverse in that engine either, which I kind of respect. No going back.
Oh, yeah.
Which is part of the intensity, even on regular.
It's because I know the tracks eventually go all the way back around, so it's fine. I'll hit you on the second time back.
Truth be told, I'm not even sure what the hell that means exactly.
I don't either, but it sounded good.
Sure so. Did. So, with that as our jumping off point, perhaps we should move on to the ludicrous leadoffs, with the two news items we have come across that we think are just an extra special layer of special here for you on this program, and two of them are indeed pretty special, and we shall, actually, I just realized that both of them take us to the other side of the world, the Eastern Hemisphere, to the Asian continent. And the first one dealing with a man who had, a damn near heart attack when this came about. So there's two very ridiculous elements to our first ludicrous leadoff here. It's a story that was posted to the South China Morning Post news agency, and they told us that there was a man in China who apparently last weekend had a bit of an unfortunate incident where a character that he had put a lot of time and especially a lot of money into, he borrowed it to his friend to play in some MMORPG called Justice Online, borrowed it to his friend, and his friend apparently put it up for sale and then sold it. So, okay, that's one thing. Part one of the ridiculousness comes from the fact that the man who created this character that was then lent to his friend and sold by accident had put apparently $1.4 million into this character for his MMORPG experience in Justice Online.
Yes, and I believe that's $1.4 American million dollars.
Yes.
Not $1.4 million dollars worth of yuan, Chinese yuan. That's just the first part, which is insane on its own. And this is just, this is for the MMORPG Justice Online, which I think is maybe mostly in China, because I hadn't really heard of it, but.
I'm going to gather it's mostly Chinese, Asian continent game. I have never heard of the title prior to coming across this story. So this guy obviously cares a lot about this game, and there's a lot he can put into it, a lot that they're selling for add-ons to the character. He puts in $1.4 million worth of stuff to this character. Okay, fine. Obviously, with that amount, you've got a really kick-ass character. People are going to want to play with it. So he borrows it to his friend, and his friend, after a weekend of playing with it, puts it up for sale in the marketplace by accident and sells it for $552 U.S. dollars.
Yeah.
552 of them.
Yes, representing a net loss of just about $1.4 million. So, yeah. It thankfully worked itself out mostly because, the guy whose character it actually was, I believe sued the company NetEase, who is the developer of this Justice Online, for basically like tried to say like, hey, this is ridiculous. I want my character back. And also for punitive damages, whatever else, for like, why'd you let this happen so easily? Mm-hmm. Blah, blah, blah. So they did, he did get his character back, his $1.4 million character back. And,
he initially had tried to, the friend apparently initially tried to sell it back to the original owner for, 388,000 yuan, which equates to 55,000, just over 55,000 US dollars. The friend, during the mediation that this, case went to, claimed that he, listed the character for so low, so little, $552, because of a typo that came about from exhaustion after playing the game for way too damn long. A marathon gaming session, just was bleary-eyed, wasn't thinking straight, didn't quite realize what they were doing, entered a typo and put in $552 instead of $55,138. So, with the low price, it was then sold to another party, another player, and, of course, the original owner was up in arms, and then took the company NetEase and all the other parties to court, to mediation court over this.
Yeah. Now, so, he got his character back, but there was a cost associated to this.
Sure were. he did not just, he was not awarded anything beyond his character back.
No. He did also have to pay 90,000 yuan, which is approximately 12,789 US dollars, to the person who got this really good deal on the character for just damages, you know, like, I guess this pain in the ass, like, this guy spent this money on this character, how, like, now you're taking it away from me, blah blah blah, I thought I found a deal.
I'm innocent in this, I have no part in this screw up on the part of these two knuckleheads. Why am I being penalized?
Yeah, exactly. So he came out on top, arguably, with this
free money.
Though it sounds like they'll probably just put this money back into this game anyways.
Yeah. If you can put $1.4 million into a character in this game, the opportunities abound for monetization. What does a $1.4 million character look like?
I don't know anything about this game, but that, what can you possibly spend that much money on? Is this like Robert Space Industries level of ridiculous, this game? Is it all cosmetic, crazy, like spaceship things that you just kind of get to look at and say, I spent $65,000 on that thing? Ooh.
I'm envisioning a character, just an individual character from a standard MMORPG, but just the most gaudy, ostentatious cosmetic appearance for the character. Just glowing golden wings in behind it.
Like Homer Simpson imagining getting all that money going, notice anything different about me, Lenny? It's like, oh yeah, you're 30 feet tall and made of gold. Like,
pretty much. Just covered in jewels and sparkles and just shoots fireworks every time it takes a step. Yeah. I'm that level of just over the top rock star style, but MMORPG character.
Yeah.
For $1.4 million. Also, who has $1.4 million to put into a character?
Who has $1.4 million to put into any, like, anything? Can I have that guy's job? Like, seriously, $1.4 million? Good God. I can do all sorts of stuff with that type of money.
Imagine all the characters you can buy.
Yeah, imagine all the games I could waste it on.
So, apparently there's a lot of money in this game in China. Justice Online.
Apparently, yeah.
Good God. So that's just the first of two ludicrous leadoffs. The second one, dealing with a game of a different nature. This takes us back to a story that we spoke of many times a couple years ago that really seemed like the harbinger of the machine uprising and the start of the downfall of humanity that would lead us to the pile of skulls as pictured in the Terminator franchise.
Yeah. Back then Google was doing some experimentation with, I believe it was this DeepMind initiative. And one of the things was they trained an AI to be able to play Go, which a lot of people thought wasn't really possible because it wasn't like a simpler game like chess, which took them a long time to kind of ramp an AI up to be able to master that. But even then, a top level chess AI can only really do okay against the chess grandmaster. Mm-hmm. Like, it can do as well, but it can't, like, obliterate a chess grandmaster. Like, it's gonna be a close game no matter what. But Go, it was actually disturbing how much of an almost no contest it was in favor of the AI in like all of these cases, to the point where they had, I believe he's the top, maybe still is the top Go player in the world, the South Korean Lee Sedol. I'm sure I'm butchering his name pronunciation. I'm sorry, but he played 5 games against this AI and lost 4 of them. And in the only victory, like it was, it almost looked like a fluke that he won.
It did. And it, the outcome almost seemed, you almost expected the AI would win, given that the AlphaGo AI system that was developed just to play the game of Go kind of carved a path of destruction on its way to eventually facing and then ultimately destroying Lee Sedol. Took down, I believe, an Asian regional Go playing champ, a European champion, and then Lee Sedol, ultimately the world champion. And we haven't really heard of much from Lee Sedol in the time since he was defeated by AlphaGo in a best of 5 back in March 2016. And in the years since, Lee Sedol has taken that time to think, to reflect, to focus, to ponder his future now that the AI system of AlphaGo exists and has proven to be a very formidable opponent, if not a superior opponent in the game of Go. And after his defeat, Lee Sedol has just recently announced that he is going to be retiring from the field of Go, from the field of competitive Go playing, literally because of his losses at the hands of the AlphaGo AI system. This is how it starts. Not only do machines take our jobs, they rob us of our will.
Yeah, and yeah, he said a lot of really kind of depressing things here. It sounds very much like he's a defeated man, like, to his core.
Yeah. I would imagine that Go was a big part of his life. I mean, to become world champion is likely even more time-consuming than a full-time job.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, he's 36, and he had a 24-year career. So he essentially devoted his life to this game.
Yes.
And for it to basically now be just wiped out with the snap of a finger, it must have been, like, devastating. Just devastating.
How do you account for this? You could never, in your, up to that point, 20-year career, 21-year career, account for an AI system coming along and so thoroughly trouncing you. No point can you account for that. No thought or mind did you ever pay it because, well, it's just not a thing that's going to happen. You're on a certain path, and then all of a sudden, boom! Environment happens and AI is just superior. So,
like, I think it was a combination of a few different things. Like, he specifically kind of, like, after saying, you know, his apologies and, you know, basically saying stuff like, you know, he felt powerless. He's not going to be able to satisfy. He wasn't able to satisfy people's expectations, blah, blah, blah. He felt like he didn't even really put up much of a fight against the AI. And he said he felt powerless again, like as like sort of like an underlying point. And then he said he's come to question the classical beliefs a little bit. So he has a lot more study to do, which is kind of a crazy thing to say because Go has been around since Chinese civilization, I think, has been around. Like, it's, what, 6,000 years old or something?
It is an amazingly old game that is very difficult to master given the possibilities that exist for any one turn in the game.
Yeah, and, like, he's now saying, like, with all of his 24 years of experience, with him being the top player in the world right now and everything, he's saying, like, there's a direct quote, I'll just read it here. He said, with the debut of AI in Go games, I've realized that I'm not at the top, even if I would become the number one through frantic efforts. Even if I become the number one, there is an entity that cannot be defeated. End
harsh.
Quote. That's really harsh. There's a competitor to, there's another AI Go competitor being developed by South Korean tech firm NHN Entertainment called Handol. Sedol is gonna, I guess he's doing another exhibition match against this thing you know, even though he's retired, but, you know.
One last kick at the can.
Yeah. They're basically handicapping the machine for him. I don't think the match has actually happened yet, but I guess this was sort of like a lead up to it before he actually retires for real. And he said, even with a 2-stone advantage, I feel like I will lose the first game to Handel. I wanted to play comfortably against Handel as I already have retired, though I will do my best.
So he's going into it and already sounding defeated.
Yeah.
Harsh.
That's really harsh. I mean, I didn't expect that to happen. Like, I figured, like, I mean, obviously I'm not in the head of, like, Lee Sedol or even in the head of someone that, you know, is, like, this would probably be tantamount to a top-level athlete being, or like a basketball player or a hockey player or something being defeated by some robot, or like even like a car, like a race car driver being defeated by like an auto-driving car or something. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, like I would still think, it's just a machine. Of course it's going to be well. Like it's, I don't know, maybe he is actually legitimately using this as a learning experience and he's just kind of phrasing it in a very defeatist, awful way. But if he's not, that's bad. And I think people close to him should be maybe concerned.
I imagine part of this has to feel as though just the path he was on feels like it has just crumbled underneath him. He was at the top of his game. He's put in thousands of hours, I would say, into studying, into practice, into playing Go competitively to achieve that standing of being tops in the world.
Yeah.
That is not something that happens overnight. You do not just achieve that title if you are a Johnny Come Lately. You earn it. And he earned it. And he was the world champion for a number of years prior to AlphaGo coming along. So he had that standing and took his craft very seriously. And I guess I can only imagine part of this is just he's been knocked from his throne and maybe doesn't know how to get back up. Now, along the way to becoming world champion, he would have had losses, but he had losses to human opponents.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, humans have the same strengths and weaknesses as kind of each other. And I mean, the differences will be just in strategies that are human level brain can come up with in a human level time frame and a human level, you know, capacity and all this stuff. So I can kind of see where he's coming from, but him basically being like, there's someone I can never beat, so I'm not going to play anymore. It's also kind of like, I'm taking my ball and going home, isn't it?
I can see that. I can certainly see that. I don't know how much I want a level of criticism given that we don't know what's going on in his head.
No, exactly. I mean, like, it's almost impossible to know. I mean, it must be devastating, but holy crap, like.
I mean, imagine if a top-level athlete in their sport, like a Sidney Crosby or a Connor McDavid for hockey or a LeBron James in basketball, is forced to retire for not of their own reasons, not of their own choosing. An injury happens to them or something, and they are devastated by that because they are in the mode of playing hockey. That is what they're doing. It is what they've devoted their life to, hockey, basketball, what name the sport you so choose. And for that to suddenly and abruptly end is not something they ever prepare for.
Right, but that's a little bit different because, like, that's an injury.
It is.
I guess maybe he's considering this an injury, though it also almost feels like an injury to his ego, if anything else. Maybe I'm being a little bit harsh, but like, you're the top human player in the world. You're going to not play humans anymore because a machine defeated you? A machine whose sole purpose was to be amazing at this one game? Like, yeah, you spent 24 years playing it, but like, also bear in mind, these things can be trained up really quickly, especially with the computing power available to like Google.
This is true. The thought that just occurred to me now as we're talking through this story and Lee Sedol leaving the world of the professional Go playing championship series is his retiring and chalking it all up to the presence of AlphaGo and the AI system that can play the game makes it sound as though AlphaGo is a competitor on the tour playing Go.
Yeah.
It isn't.
No, it isn't.
He lost in an exhibition match, and I do not know if they had follow-up series, not that I have heard or read in the years since, in the 3 years since they initially played. Oh, God, 3.5 now. Dear God. That was 3.5 years ago already? Time. Where did it go?
Yeah.
It's a flat circle. But in the 3.5 years since, AlphaGo is not on the tour. It is not winning tournaments, not collecting trophies or winnings or anything of that nature. It was a test for the DeepMind organization or Google DeepMind to see how their system would fare against a human player so they could then go make tweaks, improvements, yada, 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 then use the findings to then improve other AI systems and tweak and refine those with the, with what they have learned and may apply to other unique, distinct AI systems throughout the DeepMind family. So he's been broken for 3.5 years.
Yeah.
Maybe he just needs to take a long vacation.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, sometimes it just take, you know, just some time.
Yeah. Somewhere nice and warm.
Yeah. Or cold. I don't know. Maybe he
just maybe needs that's the thing.
I don't know.
Just solitary cold isolation.
Yeah. Or something.
Yeah, something. Something maybe, to take his mind off this.
Maybe get on a boat, go into the middle of a lake and go fishing or something. Like, I don't know. Everyone unwinds in different ways.
This is true. So, but either way, Lee Sedol, broken by AI. And if it can break a world champion Go player, what would it do to the normal man? I mean, it's taking jobs through automation at factories throughout the world.
I mean, that's definitely true.
What's it coming for next? I feel like this would be the part where we edit in the Terminator sound.
Yeah. But we're too lazy. We yeah, won't be doing that tonight. So,
we'll move on and try and lift your spirits up right now as we get into the other news of the week and lifting your spirits and with something that AI cannot do, and that is care for other humans. Care for and care about other people that they do not know, simply, and do things out of a sense of good and community service for them. And we are going to speak about the good people over at Loading Ready Run, who just earlier this month, just a few weeks ago, held their 2019 version of Desert Bus for Hope. If you're unfamiliar with that, it is a several-day-long telethon with people playing the experience that is Desert Bus.
Yeah.
Which is not a game, it is a journey.
Yeah, I mean, it is a game, because there's points, there's an objective, there's a level.
There is a level.
Or two levels, arguably, if you want to consider it that way. But it's more of an anti-game, clearly developed as a joke on as part of a collection of games that was unreleased for Sega CD back in 1995, entitled Penn and Teller's Smoke and Mirrors. If you've never looked up Desert, or if you don't know what Desert Bus is, pause for a second and look it up. Don't need to get into it. It's like, it's stupid. It's,
watch it was the full playthrough.
Yeah. Or don't, cause it's like 9 hours long. It's a real time trip between Las Vegas and
Tucson,
Arizona. So yeah, it's, you're basically just taking one person back and forth, and then you get a point for each successful completion, but you can't just like let it go because the bus veers to the left and you have to constantly be steering it kind of thing. It's a huge pain in the ass. But what Loading Ready Run started doing 12 years ago is they basically turned it into a streaming marathon where they just play the game for as long as they possibly can while donations keep coming in, and the donations go towards various charities, like whatever they're doing of the year. Like, I think Doctors Without Borders was 1 year, and I think...
I believe this year was Child's Play.
Yeah, Child's Play. Maybe it's always Child's Play. I might be mixing up my video game charities in my head.
Oh, with Games Done Quick.
With Games Done Quick as well, but yeah. Desert Bus for Hope is one of the 10-pole game charities of the year that, you know, seems to happen on an annual basis now, which is good. Because it's always entertaining. I think it usually lasts for about, you know, a week or so now, and there's, you know, nerd celebrity cameos and stuff, and they have people dropping in and playing and hanging out for a while in their...
And they have live auctions too, as the, as someone is playing Desert Bus. It's not just you watching someone play Desert Bus the entire time.
No, it's a very interactive experience.
It certainly is, and the, you know, more recent technologies, live streaming, things of that nature, have certainly helped make it much more interactive, a more engrossing and entertaining experience as well for the viewers at home. And also, I guess, all the other people involved in the poor sucker in the chair at the moment who has to drive the bus back and forth between Vegas and Tucson.
Yeah.
Keep it on the straight and narrow. That is a thankless job.
Yeah. Not to mention, if you crash the bus, having to wait for the tow truck to get there and then being towed back in real time. That's the other thing that might be the funniest part of the game.
I forgot about that.
Yeah. Don't worry. I remember stupid crap like that. But yeah, so this year, I think it's a record for their, you know, what, for their raising power this year.
It certainly is. It's a very impressive amount, over the 6 to 7 day, I think just over 6 day, live streaming telethon that they did. Desert Bus for Hope this year brought in $864,415, all going towards the Child's Play charity. $864,000 just for playing Desert Bus for Hope, or playing Desert Bus in the Desert Bus for Hope event. So that is impressive and tops last year's amount by a goodish margin. In 2018, Desert Bus for Hope brought in just over $730,000. So an increase of almost $135,000 year on year.
Yeah, and in the past 12 years, that brings their total up to just over $6 million raised for charity. So they're putting in the work. They're doing it.
Impressive.
Yeah.
If we were wearing caps at the moment, we would tip them, we would doff them to everyone involved with Loading Ready Run, everyone working, putting in the volunteer hours for Desert Bus for Hope. It's a big thing to organize.
Yeah.
And I don't know if, the people behind the scenes necessarily always get the thanks, the kudos, to organize, to schedule, to set up the streams, to write schedules for who's doing what and when, to wrangle people. Wrangling people can be a pain in the ass. It's like herding sheep or cats sometimes. But with a cause like this, everyone turns themselves over to it. They do it. And the people in the chair who have to play Desert Bus and take the shifts driving the bus to and from Vegas and Tucson, kudos to everyone involved. They are doing the good work. And to them we say, keep it up. They are impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, just a side note as well, like if you're interested in Magic the Gathering, they have some really great Magic the Gathering content as well. They do Friday night streams for Magic and stuff, and it's good stuff. They have a lot of content on their channel. They've been going for a long time, clearly. So give them a follow, check them out. It's good stuff.
Certainly. So, that is that. And, all right, there's nothing else to talk about, so we should probably just move into the blast from the past here. Nothing else has happened in the past 7 to 14 days, so we'll just keep it a nice and tight show this week. So, two blasts from the past.
You are joking, but...
I was going to see how long you let me go.
You are joking, but in a way we almost are doing a blast from the past at this point. Remember, I think it was last week or last show, two weeks ago, when we talked about Half-Life 2?
Yes.
And
being 10 years old.
It being 10 years old, and, you know, we basically...
No, 14. We're 15.
15 years old? Yeah, yeah, and we had basically given up on there ever being a third game to satisfyingly complete the trilogy, to not leave the game on a stupid cliffhanger. And, well, that's not going to happen, but...
Yeah, we're still waiting.
We're still waiting. No news on that front has actually come out, but there has been news of a new Half-Life game being announced.
Indeed. So the big news, of course, yeah, you likely have heard, but now we are going to chime in and have our say on it because we were away last week with life getting in the way, Dennis needing some me time, and me having some throat issues, which, let me tell you, if you've got a sore throat, it sucks going to work because... your throat just doesn't really get better anytime soon.
No, especially if you need to talk to people and do stuff like that. Yeah. It's awful.
It takes that much longer. So I'm finally starting to feel better with that. But because we were away last week, who could not chime in then on Half-Life Alyx, as it is now called, a spin-off game in the Half-Life universe, to hell with Gordon Freeman. This is a game set between the events of Half-Life 1 and Half-Life 2, and, of course, meaning that we will never see Half-Life 3 or Half-Life 2 Episode 3 or any sort of third chapter at the end of the Half-Life franchise.
Yeah.
So this is in between, and it is set for release on virtual reality headsets, and it is being released in March 2020. So there's a lot to digest here, or is there a lot to digest here? That's the question.
It doesn't feel like there's a lot to digest here, other than it's a Half-Life game in VR, and it's not part of the Half-Life, like, it is part of the Half-Life canon, takes place between the first and second games, but it doesn't move the story forward.
No, it does not. And it's set in a world in a city that we saw in Half-Life episode 2, and or Half-Life 2, I should say, episode 1 and then episode 2. So we've been there. We have experienced the character of Alyx Vance already, though experienced her as she would interact with Gordon Freeman. Gordon Freeman, of course, being the main protagonist of the Half-Life series.
Yeah.
The one that everyone has become accustomed to playing as.
Yeah. So
the strong but silent hero.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a kind of tired trope at this point, but it still works from, you know, it still works. That's why it's a trope. So, but yeah, so I didn't really get a lot out of this trailer other than it's VR. Looks like there's a lot of like hand movements that you have to kind of fine hand movements, I would say, that you kind of have to do with, you know, loading guns and catching things and throwing things and, you know, quickly maneuvering around and, you know, not getting your face eaten off by a face hugger or, you know,
head crab
or taking after, you know, people who are, you know, I don't know, whatever. It's it doesn't really say a lot, and it looks like a VR game.
It's true. It very much looks like a VR game, and the hands of Alyx Vance are just always there in front of you the whole time.
Disembodied
hands, though with some elements of technology on them, some resistance-type technology that has been scrounged around and no doubt cobbled together by some Aussie character who's in the game and is there for diversity. Why there's an Australian fellow, I don't know, but there is, so that's a thing, but seems like there's some element of magnetism to the magic hand gloves you wear in the game as well. It's not a gravity gun, but
it's a gravity hand?
As you can bring objects towards you and summon them and whatnot. I do agree with your assessment that the trailer is very handsy, hands-on, and hand-centric.
Yeah, but also not very information-heavy.
No. It is set in the same city as Half-Life 2. You're fighting some of the same characters before Gordon Freeman comes on the scene to, of course, save the day. And yeah, you're playing a VR version of Half-Life. Is this what people wanted?
I don't know. I think the answer is, you know, the instinctive answer is no. People want Half-Life 3. They want a conventional Half-Life to, you know, finish off the series, end everything, whatever. But, yeah. I think that this actually, you know, all the stuff we talked about Half-Life 2, how it kind of did a lot for, you know, game narration and, like, immersiveness, like, 15 years ago when it came out. You know, it did a lot of really interesting things that hadn't really been done before in games. This has the potential to maybe move that even forward with VR. Like, we're still kind of dipping our toes into VR at this point, honestly. Like, it's still, that new of a technology, and I don't think anyone's really mastered storytelling with VR yet. But maybe this could be a way to move that forward. Maybe. I'm giving it a lot of the benefit of the doubt.
Yes, the appearance from the trailer is that it's trying to be innovative with its control scheme, and I guess with, you know, playing it on VR, you have your hand controllers, your whatever apparatus you're using for whatever VR headset you are playing with, and it seems to attempt immersion through your interaction of flailing your arms around with the environment. Not necessarily through story, not necessarily through other characters or the sense of a world around you that we see from the trailer, but being very controller-centric in terms of immersion, which I have concerns about because that is something we saw with the Wii and the Wii Remote. Flailing arms around wildly didn't really work for immersion. Although that was only one sense that was being engaged with the wild flailing of your arms.
Yeah, there wasn't really the sense of, you know, your sight and hearing being taken entirely over by another, like, by a virtual reality. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it kind of makes sense. I mean, it, like, when done well, like, these games, it feels pretty good to, be able to use your hands in that sense. You know, when they feel like they're where your hands should actually be, and they're not just kind of awkwardly represented on some screen 5 feet away from you. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm still always kind of wary of, you know, trying to replace one experience with another instead of, like, using it as a supplementary kind of experience. If that makes any sense.
No, I get it, because they seem like they're putting their focus on the technology as opposed to necessarily the story, if you
will. Yeah.
The story of the characters, fleshing that out, and whatnot. But with this being the announcement of a new Half-Life game, there were quotes in the press release from Gabe Newell, who crawled out of his Scrooge McDuck-like vault of coins from his daily dip and offered up some words on the matter, saying, quote, VR has energized us. We've invested a lot of ourselves in the technology, but we're also game developers at heart, and to be devoting ourselves to a VR game this ambitious is just as exciting. For that to come in the form of Half-Life feels like the culmination of a lot of things we care a lot about. Truly great games, cutting-edge technology, and open platforms. We can't wait for people to experience this. End quote. So, by the sounds of it, between Gabe Newell's quote and also a later developer roundtable that was posted to YouTube and hosted by Jeff Keighley, it sounds like the real crux of this was VR technology. That's what got them going and motivated them to work on a Half-Life title. Apparently, by the sounds of it, from some of the developers, the idea and concept of working on a Half-Life title was very daunting and maybe a bit too much for them to try and grasp and get their arms around, if you will, get a handle on it. But then they started playing around with VR, and what could they do in VR with Half-Life that, I guess, hasn't been done before, because there hasn't been a Half-Life VR game. So a bit of a clean slate or fresh slate for them to play with. So make of that what you will, with one individual, Robin Walker of Valve, saying, quote, in some ways, VR was like the way the gravity gun helped us in Half-Life 2. It became the tentpole that we could wrap everything around, end quote. So really, VR was the focus for this game from the outset. And apparently it's been in development for, what did I read somewhere? Something like 9 years?
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me. Though it sounds like it was a thing that was sort of restarted several times as well. I mean, just look for the video of, I think it was a supercut someone made of all the times Gabe Newell talked about Half-Life 3 in media and, like, through the years, and the further away from Half-Life 2, Episode 2, right after Episode 2, he's still like, yeah, Episode 3 is going to come out next month kind of thing. And people are like, holy crap, really? And then it, like, got delayed to the point where it's like, they just stopped talking about it. People would ask him and he wouldn't even answer. He'd be like, next question. So it's like, huh. But Robin Walker actually, you know, continued. He was saying, in all honesty, back in 2016 when we started this, Half-Life 3 was just daunting. So, I mean, 2016, I think, is when his team kind of picked this up. Mm-hmm. And, you know...
So this has probably been floating around the Valve office for a while.
Yeah. Now, whether or not it was... Whether or not that confirms that they actually have Half-Life 3 on their mind, like maybe this, maybe this should almost be a confirmation that yes, they're thinking about it and they're thinking really hard about it to the point where they're like, we don't want to mess it up. So let's just, you know, release another Half-Life related game to try to get those juices flowing. Maybe like, maybe that's what this actually is.
It's them jamming again. To parallel them to a band.
Yeah. Because, you know, honestly, like when was the last game that they like really released? Was it one of the Left 4 Dead games, or was it Portal 2?
I'm wondering if it was Portal 2.
I mean, I don't have the...
There has been so little in between.
Yeah.
That it's hard to even remember now, which is surprising given that Valve is good at games.
Yeah. Like, they are actually a legitimately great game developer. Like they're not just some company that just had a couple of good games, got some money together, and then just got really lucky by releasing Steam. No, like, they were noted for being, like, kind of like revolutionary game developers back in the day. Like, they came out with all sorts of crazy stuff that became staples, like Counter-Strike Source, mm-hmm. or like Counter-Strike Go, and like, you know,
Team Fortress,
like Portal was mind-blowing. Portal 2, like these are all classic games at this point. Like they deserve to be, you know, heralded as like one of the great game developers, but you know, it's obviously like, I think it should be obvious why it's fair for all of these, like all of us, you know, unwashed masses to be kind of frustrated when it's like, oh, they're just not doing games anymore. Fine. But maybe like this kind of tells me it's like, oh, so maybe they have legitimately been trying and they've been kicking ideas around and they're like, just maybe they're all in their own head about it. Like, no, it has to be perfect. It has to wrap up our, you know, cause like Half-Life is clearly like their main franchise, mm-hmm. which like there's a bunch of auxiliary things built around Half-Life, but Half-Life was like, this is the driving force. What keeps us going? Like
if a band had just released, or 10 years ago released their one of the greatest albums ever, and they have to follow that up.
Yeah.
How do you get a handle on that? Where do you start? How do you not repeat yourself, but still do some of what worked, but still innovate and do something new and whatnot? And I don't know if there's a good answer to that. It's a creative process. You work through it and try to come up with the best thing possible, you'd imagine. But of course, that's easy for me to say. I don't have millions of dollars on the line. So there's that. But to anyone out there who may have heard the news that Half-Life Alyx is going to be on VR and thought, oh, well, maybe this will just come to PC and some other platforms one day, that's a big nope. That's a hard no, as it were. It's not going to come to PC, at least anytime soon, or at least just regular mouse and keyboard PC, with Dario Casali in that developer roundtable with Jeff Keighley saying that the VR controllers and headsets give them a degree of gameplay detail that, quote, we couldn't possibly do with a mouse and keyboard. With Casali in the video citing the example of a level of immersion, intuitive fashion in VR that you get, such as interacting with a door and the ability just to kind of prop open the door ever so slightly, slightly more, just open a crack and then, you know, pop your gun through, fire for a shot and maybe take out an enemy or something and then quickly close the door again so you're protected. That kind of thing, which, okay, sure. If that's what they're going for, cool. I don't know. There are joysticks, though. That was my first thought.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
They're putting a lot of emphasis on the controllers here.
Yeah. So
that's concerning to me because
that's what Nintendo did with the Switch.
Well,
or not the Switch, but the Wii, sorry.
That is what Nintendo did with the Wii, but also Half-Life was, you know, the great things about Half-Life weren't the controls.
No, like it, like.
They were solid.
Yeah, like, the controls were good. It, you know, it was equally playable on a mouse and keyboard as it was on, like, a game controller, in my opinion. Like, you can get good with both, but the things that people liked about Half-Life were the gameplay in general and, like, the cool story.
And the diversity of gameplay experience. It's intense shooter, run for your life. There's vehicle like, driving.
And, like, there's RPG, like, adventure elements where you have characters you meet, like the crazy priest in that one, like, cursed town. I don't remember the name of it. Raven?
Yes.
Raven something?
Something.
Ravenburg or something like that. Like a wide array of like interesting characters and like cool story and interesting gameplay mechanics like the gravity gun and stuff. Like,
I mean, the wow factor of first getting the gravity gun and there being just the huge farm saw blades right there.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you've just immediately showed how crazy powerful this crazy gun is. Okay, interesting. It's not just a bang, bang, shoot, shoot, whatever gun. Now we can just, everything's a weapon. And there's various interesting ways you can do this. It's the same kind of mind-blowing thing with, like, Portal. When you first get the Portal gun, it's like, oh, you just broke my brain. Okay.
And how many of those positive things we spoke of were based around the controllers?
None of them.
And control scheme.
None of them. And there were all these gameplay elements that were agnostic to the input mechanism. Like it's, I don't know, but
one neat thing about Half-Life Alyx that, or with the announcement of Half-Life Alyx that kind of was overshadowed with all the hullabaloo is the fact that, with Half-Life Alyx, Valve is also going to be releasing a set of Source 2 tools for people out there to create their own content, including environments that will run and work in the game itself of Half-Life Alyx. And yeah, so how much you can do is still up for interpretation. The official announcement on it saying, quote, a set of Source 2 tools for building new levels will be available for the game, enabling any player to build and contribute new environments for the community to enjoy. Hammer, Valve's level authoring tool, has been updated with all of the game's virtual reality gameplay tools and components, end quote. So you can go and make your own levels and whatnot and content for Half-Life Alyx and just a new set of tools to play with. By the sounds of it, free to play with, free to use, free to play with.
Yeah.
If you start selling stuff, I don't know the mechanics of that, but
there's probably some sort of licensing thing, but all that aside, it's cool. It's always cool to get new tools to play around with when you're interested in that sort of thing.
It is, and Valve releases some pretty powerful tools. So that is a neat thing. So March 2020, Half-Life Alyx on the VR platform of your choice, only for VR platforms, as far as we know. I would not be surprised if down the line it comes to the next-gen consoles.
For their VR platforms?
Sure. Who the hell knows? But $60 price point, I believe, or free if you are on the Valve Index VR headset. So keep that in mind. But let's move to another game that is of here and now that is doing gangbusters already, as we kind of thought it would. Pokemon Sword and Shield is only about 2 weeks old at this point. But just after the first week, Nintendo put out a press release heralding the global success of the new mainline entry in the Pokemon series, Sword and Shield. Of course, the big killer title for Nintendo this holiday season, and it is killing it. A crazy record and a crazy amount of games sold. Not shipped to stores or anything, but sold through. Nintendo, in a press release, announcing that Pokemon Sword and Shield, within its first week on the marketplace, sold over 6 million units, which is pretty damn impressive. That is 6 million units across the globe. That is including both digital sales and physical sales, so that's pretty damn good. And that's a record that tops Smash Brothers Ultimate from last year, or sorry, from it was last year, that sold 5 million units in its opening week. So Pokemon Sword and Shield, now the fastest selling Switch game in the history of the Switch, which is, granted, not that long.
No, it's not that long, but it's still impressive. And if I'm being honest, I think I want to count myself as one of the people that wants to get that game sooner than later. It looks pretty cool.
It really does.
Like, it's the first time in years and years and years since I've been actually interested in wanting to play a Pokemon game, but it's the, I'm not going to lie, it's the prospect of actually being able to play it on my television that is a large portion of that, so.
And this is the first time you'll have that ability.
Yeah, which is like, oh, okay, so they're treating it like a big full-scale RPG, which it technically is, it always has been, and now I can, you know, devote the proper amount of time and attention and lack of neck strain to it.
And if you're just on a hot streak of Pokemon Sword and Shield playing, you can take it on the go with you as well.
Yeah, exactly.
So there is that respect. Nintendo also saying within the first 2 days of being on sale in the U.S., Pokemon Sword and Shield did 2 million copies in sales in 2 days.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Good God. So Nintendo is going to have a very good Christmas, and I'm sure a lot of people out there are going to be getting Sword and Shield this holiday season. Quick, do you have a preference between Sword or Shield? Because for some reason, of the two in the Pokemon franchise, one always sells a bit better than the other. Red or Blue, Sun and Moon, X and Y, you know, Gold and Silver, that sort of thing. So one is always preferred by a bit more people over the other.
I legitimately have no idea. No idea whatsoever.
All right. You would just kind of get to the store and choose from...
I mean, I'd probably take a quick look before, you know, buying, you know, maybe whatever, like, what are the starting Pokemon? Is it really a kneecapping factor if I get one over the other? Like, which, you know, what's the deal with one or the other? I don't know. Ultimately, it might just turn into an eeny, meeny, miny, moe, but we'll see.
Whichever one has the better looking box art.
Yeah. Or whichever one is in stock, I guess, when I go to buy. Who knows?
Whatever the case might be, I'm sure Pokemon Sword and Shield, when we get to this point next year, will no doubt be up for some of the Game Awards. The Game Awards taking place in LA, in a week and a half, if I recall correctly. Yes, on December 12th. Yes. Thankfully, I was able to look at my paper so subtly that no one knew that I was stalling to find the correct date.
Excellent. Indeed.
The fact that I called attention to anything just had no impact whatsoever, because you're all certain that I was with the information at the ready. Yes, but it's on December 12th at the Microsoft Theater in Los Angeles. The nominations for those Game Awards have come out. We're not going to go through the extensive list, because it is a very extensive list for with awards for your standard categories like Game of the Year, Game Direction, Voice Acting,
Best Score, things like that.
Yeah, best this genre of game, but also awards for esports categories, esports player of the year, team of the year, host of the year. Sure.
Yeah, there's 29 categories all told.
Which is too damn many categories.
Yeah, it's quite a lot, but
we'll pick out some of the bigger ones just to note here.
Well, the big observation, I think, is that it looks like maybe it's because they're friends, but it looks like Kojima is going to clean up probably with Death Stranding.
Somehow I would not be surprised by that.
Like, it's showing up in all sorts of different categories, like Game of the Year, Best Game Direction, Best Narrative, Best Art Direction, Best Score, Best Audio Design. It's well represented in Best Performance. I mean, due in no small part to the fact that they've got legitimately like 5 or 6 A-list actors actually captured in the game, not to mention countless, who knows how many countless cameos, including Conan O'Brien.
I would love it if Conan was nominated for a Best Performance award. He's not, but
no, but
that would be amazing.
Yeah, but yeah, it has quite the showing, but it's not alone. Of course, there's other games that are nominated for a lot of different things as well. The Outer Worlds actually makes a pretty strong showing as well, considering it's an independent game. Sekiro Shadows Die Twice was like, I guess, the Dark Souls-ish kind of, I think it's made by FromSoft. Yeah, it's their Dark Souls entry mm-hmm. this year, basically. Resident Evil 2, which, you know, cool. Control, Death Stranding, Super Smash Bros. Ultimate. Yeah, lots of...
Yeah, that's the game of the year category right there.
Yeah, like that's legitimately it. But then all these titles show up in some configuration, you know, for best game direction, best narrative, best art direction, and best score as well. With a couple of like differences here and there, of course, but pretty consistent for all of those. Like, those are the big categories, really. Maybe not best score, but you know, game of the year, best game direction, best narrative, best art direction. Though I don't, part of me doesn't, I know what the difference is, but it seems kind of weird splitting like best game direction from best art direction in a way. Cause aren't games art? Anyways.
Yeah. That's a whole other kettle of fish.
Yeah.
But best performance, we can also pick out there. As you said, Death Stranding, well represented, for that category, both Mads Mikkelsen and Norman Reedus nominated for awards there. That is so not surprising. But also Matthew Peretta, and Courtney Hope from their performances in Control nominated up against the Death Stranding boys as well. Also Ashley Birch in there for her work in The Outer Worlds, as is Laura Bailey from Gears 5.
Yeah.
So, some strong performances this year.
I'm actually Conan rooting.
O'Brien, shut out.
Yeah, Conan O'Brien, shut out. Though I am rooting for Ashley Birch. Parvati was a really cool character and, yeah, very brave character to even have in a video game, I think. As an asexual lesbian, who would have thought? Weird character to include, but you know, representation's good, I guess.
It's true.
For people, and it's a cool story. Anyways, yeah. So, I'm just gonna put it out there. I'm pretty sure Death Stranding is probably gonna clean up, you know, mostly because we know that Jeff Keighley and Hideo Kojima are friends.
They are, although I think in the aftermath of the nominations being announced, a lot of people went online and offered the criticism that, well, Death Stranding, of course it's nominated for a whole bunch because him and Jeff Keighley are friends. Jeff Keighley then had to do his best damage control on online, on social media, and say that he had no vote in the voting or nomination process.
Yeah, okay.
Apparently he abstained. Whatever you think of that, but I believe there's a voting panel of 20 to 30 industry professionals, media professionals, or game media professionals that are supposed to take this seriously. I don't know if direction is given. I don't know, but anytime there's an award show, especially when it comes to games, I'm always going to be jaded from the Spike TV Game Awards experience where those were just clearly bought and paid for by whoever cut the biggest check.
Yeah, just essentially commercials for whatever games are supposed to be coming out.
Yeah, so I believe Jeff Keighley is earnest in his attempt to make genuine and true and honest video game award shows, but they're expensive to do.
Yeah.
And you need to underwrite and recoup costs somehow. And, you know, that money talks. Call me crazy, but we'll see. The awards are handed out December 12th, or maybe he knows that everyone's going to be looking at that and other games win.
Yeah,
to maybe dispel any sort of criticism that you know, may befall him. Who knows?
Maybe Death Stranding gets entirely shut out and the friendship between Hideo Kojima and Jeff Keighley comes to an end in this 2019, the year of our Lord.
Crazier things have happened.
It's true.
So, yeah, we shall see the awards handed out again December 12th at the Microsoft Theater in Los Angeles. But we shall move right along to now we get into the final segment of the show, The Blast from the Past, which I toyed with and joked about and teased earlier before we got into the discussion on Valve and Half-Life Alyx and all that stuff. But we will, honest and for true, Now get into the blast from the past. If you're not familiar, it's the segment of the show where we like to end off and take a few minutes to just kind of reminisce, fet, wax nostalgic about some things marking milestone anniversaries. They could be TV shows, video games, movies, albums, whatever tickles our fancy and catches our attention that we deem worth talking about this week. And we have two items. One is a movie. One is an album. There is no connection or correlation between the two of them whatsoever. Beyond just the mediums that they are from. But there's no way to thread the two of them together. Just they're completely different entities as they exist in the world. So I shall put the question to you now. Where do you wish to start between the two of them?
Well, we can probably start with the newer of the two things. And ashamedly, I don't think I've ever actually seen this movie. For some reason, when I was a kid, I was never really a fan of Chevy Chase. Mm-hmm. There was something about him that rubbed me the wrong way. So I never really sought out any of his vacation movies. Though, as an adult that appreciates comedy now, you know, I look at this and go, maybe I should watch this. I understand the vacation movies are kind of comedy classics, and I'd probably like it. There's things about them, blah, blah, blah. But this is a perfect opportunity now that it's a blast from the past and it's celebrating its 30th year anniversary. It is National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
Absolutely. So as the calendar is now turning into the month of December, you are going to see this movie played on TV. You're going to hear people talk about it. People are going around you are going to dig it out and watch it. You might be watching it of your own choice. You might be forced to watch it. Regardless, this is one of those classic Christmas movies that will be played, heard, spoken of in the next couple weeks in the lead up to Christmas, because that is coming very fast.
It sure is.
But to me, this is one of my all-time favorite Christmas movies. It is funny as hell. I absolutely enjoy it as being a funny movie. Now, it is not a wacky, shticky, over-the-top movie. It is very much rooted in an earnestness of Chevy Chase's character, of Clark Griswold, who genuinely wants to have a nice, big family Christmas at his house in Chicago. That is his desire. He loves Christmas, and he just wants to have a very nice family gathering. And he's very staunch in his devotion to that desire to have a nice, wonderful Christmas holiday. He perhaps goes to some levels of zealousy with it, but it is still rooted and understandable that he would go there because he's somewhat fanatical about it. Hijinks ensue along the way, some of them environmental and still funny, some of them based from his own going down the rabbit hole, if you will, of devotion to Christmas, but all of it I enjoy as being a worthwhile comedy endeavor. It does not beat you over the head with, you know, the spirit of the season or some sort of, you know, message about Christmas. It's about a guy just wanting to be with his family at Christmas.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good message.
It is a good message, and it does not do things necessarily in some wacky, zany, over-the-top manner. It can be subtle with its comedy and not so subtle with its comedy at times. And written by John Hughes, which I don't think most people know.
No, I mean, like, the Vacation series, I believe, was based on a comic that John Hughes, or a story John Hughes wrote when he was back at the National Lampoon.
Back in school.
Back in Harvard. So, like, he was part of the National Lampoon back in the day, like, part of that whole...
Back when it was a publication.
Back when it was a publication, back in that legendary early days of the Lampoon. John Hughes was one of the people there, you know, alongside people like Chevy Chase, who was kind of around, you know, as well as, like, lots of other people who sort of became kind of comedy legends.
Because the Lampoon at the time was just, I guess now in hindsight, just a factory for great comedians, comedy writers, comic performers, you name it. But it was just such a great breeding ground for them. And it started off life in school at Harvard as an unofficial school magazine.
Yeah, like it was the funny magazine for like the... the funny people, like, you know, Doug Kenny, Henry Beard, Robert Hoffman, all the founders there, who are all like notably crazy people, basically, but, Doug Kenny, especially the most out of all of them, who ended up burning himself out way too fast and dying pretty early on. But yeah, John Hughes is part of that group. And, you know, of course, like old stories and things from National Lampoon, a lot of them did end up getting made into movies and things like that. And there's tons of National Lampoon movies. I mean, Animal House being the first, going all the way up until recent years. There's even a recent Vacation movie.
Oh, that's right. There was.
Which was, I believe it was Ed Helms was basically supposed to be like
the son.
The son, like the Chuck Griswold kind of, you know, character. But yeah, it's,
which makes sense because they recast the,
Clark Griswold. Sorry. Not Chuck Griswold, but,
Clark Griswold's son. Chevy Chase being Clark Griswold in all of the Vacation movies, and they tried relaunching with Ed Helms as the son, and they recast the kids in each of the Vacation movies.
Yeah.
But maintained Chevy Chase and Beverly D'Angelo as the same in all of them.
Yeah.
Which, she is the loving, devoted husband trying, or loving, devoted wife to her husband who's crazy for Christmas. She's trying to get by and cope as best she can while still being strong and, you know, tending to everything that needs tending, and as hijinks ensue around her, and things, of course, devolve into chaos once you get a lot of people in a household all at the same time.
Yeah.
As happens at any Christmas, really.
Yeah, I mean, that's just what life is like. But,
So if you haven't already, I would recommend, watching National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation this holiday season.
I believe I will this holiday season.
Excellent. So let us move on from there to something completely different. We will move back to November 30th, 1979. It was a Tuesday, I believe. No, I'm kidding. I don't know for sure.
No.
Though if it is a Tuesday, I'm awesome. That is the day, November 30th, 1979, when one of the classic rock albums, rock and roll albums, was released. And we're talking about it not really for its rock or roll, but for what it did as a concept album. We are speaking of Pink Floyd's The Wall.
Yeah. It's their big one. It's the album with the majority of the songs that you know by Pink Floyd on. Like, it's the one that you... Yeah, I don't know. I always kind of like...
It's their Half-Life 2.
In a weird way, maybe, yeah. I mean, it's not my favorite Pink Floyd album, but it is the one that most people know the most of. And Pink Floyd is one of those bands, I've said it once, I'll say it again, and I'll say it probably 100 times. If you are aware vaguely, like, you might be someone that thinks, I don't really know any Pink Floyd songs. You know Pink Floyd songs. You've heard some Pink Floyd songs before. You just don't know they're Pink Floyd songs. They're one of those bands. It's kind of like them, or like, there's lots of bands like that. It's just, they're one of them.
And maybe then once, Rush.
Maybe Rush is another one. Maybe even like more contemporary examples that, you know, I realized a while back, like, oh, I actually think I know a lot of, maybe like Billy Talent songs or something, like, oh, I didn't think I really did, but no, I guess I know lots of them, or even Green Day songs or something like that, where it's like, oh, that's a Green Day song? Well, yeah, okay. Or it's like, they're one of those bands, or Radiohead's another one, where you might think, oh yeah, I remember that song. Well, yeah, I guess that is Radiohead, or whatever like that. Pink Floyd is one of those, for sure. But yeah, I think undeniably this has most of the songs that people generally know, like Comfortably Numb, Another Brick in the Wall, you know,
Young Lust,
Mother, like, I'm just going by memory here. I can scroll down on this Wikipedia page I have open and actually look, like, In the Flesh, Goodbye Blue Sky, you know, Goodbye and Cruel World.
These songs have lived on in the 40 years since as, you know, staples of rock radio anywhere.
Yeah.
Certainly in North America.
Hey You is another one.
Yep.
You know, like Run Like Hell. Yeah. And then, you know, it's, this is an album where, like, conceptually it went on to become much bigger than just an album. Of course, now they made the movie based on it. Then after that, you know, Roger Waters basically made a big stage production.
He toured
the shit out of that stage production, like, for the last 40 years. Like, he still does it from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's, yeah, it's, I'd be surprised if you've never heard it before, but, you know, it's a double album, so it might be a bit of a daunting listen, but, you know, if you're not sure what to listen to at work one day and you're going through Spotify thinking, yeah, what am I in the mood for? Throw on some Pink Floyd. Throw this album on. It's a good time. I mean, like,
it's an easy listen.
It's a very easy listen.
It's not necessarily a cheery uppity listen.
No.
It's not a cheery uppity album. It's not a big party rock album like Kiss is going to produce.
No.
This is a concept album. Roger Waters envisioned it, being semi-autobiographical about a character named Pink, who's kind of the, well, singer, in a big rock band and kind of who withdraws into themselves, and puts up, walls around them and, between them and others, and goes into the somewhat psychological reasons for that and whatnot, as told through song, and it's an exploration through that. So this is, really what happens when you have the words of Roger Waters and the guitar of David Gilmour.
Yeah.
This is Pink Floyd.
And a lot of the time, the voice of David Gilmour as well.
Yes.
I mean, Roger Waters, as competent of a singer as he is, he's not the best singer in the band.
This is the thought I had earlier today when I was re-listening to this album. He's mediocre.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he doesn't have a range.
No, I mean, like, he was the one that wrote all their classic songs, but he doesn't really have a great vocal range. Like, he kind of struggles to hit notes. That might have just been for dramatic effect and stuff too, but like, it's like night and day when David Gilmour comes in, because he's got that smooth, good voice, and it's just like, oh yeah, it's not pitchy at all, and like, he's got a good tone, and that's David Gilmour singing now. Okay.
Yeah, Roger Waters sounds like a regular person singing in a rock band.
Yeah.
If I was to attempt it, I feel like I'd be on par with Roger Waters. Because I was singing along at work when I was listening to it today. I'm like, I'm kind of harmonizing. Can I sing in Pink Floyd?
Could I be Roger Waters?
Career change?
Career change? But all that aside, I mean, like, it's still a great album.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
All that stuff aside, like, it's...
Like, the vocal presence of Roger Waters does not detract from this album. It's not designed to soar or hit low notes or whatever. This is not a big, rollicking, Bruce Dickinson or Rob Halford affair.
No. But it doesn't.
He wrote it for his range.
Yeah, he wrote it for his range, and, you know, it accomplishes what it's supposed to accomplish. Like, it's, yeah, it is an achievement, and it is, you know, one of the great albums in the rock canon and stuff. Again, I will go on to say my favorite Pink Floyd album is Dark Side of the Moon. But that's just, I'm sure if you are a fan of a band like that, you are going to have your own album. I mean, I have other friends who love Pink Floyd as well. And like, it's just as common for people to say, no, Animals is my album, or no, Wish You Were Here is my album. Or, you know, if you're super weird, you're going to say something like Adam Hart Mother, Amagama or something. But like, yeah, I mean, like, I don't think anyone's going to say, I hate The Wall. What a crappy album. Like, no, it's because, yeah, I don't know. Anyways, The Wall. Thumbs up. Two thumbs up.
Two thumbs up from Dennis here for this 40-year-old album now, marking its 40th anniversary on November 30th. Thank God. That's the last piece of affirmation that The Wall needed.
I mean, if I didn't do it, who knows if this album would have gone anywhere.
That's true.
Further than what it's already done.
It would have died on the vine.
Yeah.
That 40-year-old vine.
Yeah, it's been ripening all this time.
You've just reinvigorated it.
Yeah, I just stopped it from going bad, really.
Yep, and because of your recommendation for people to listen to it at work on Spotify, it's getting back into the top 10 of the Spotify charts.
Oh, yeah, and the Pink Floyd is eventually going to make maybe $8.
Hey, that's like $8 million normal dollars. Given the
the outrageous money to play ratio that you get on Spotify, yeah.
So Pink Floyd's The Wall, 40 years old, and before that we spoke of National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, one of the all-time classic Christmas movies, coming out on December 1st, 1989. It's 30 years old. Dennis says he's going to check it out this holiday season as he's softening to Chevy Chase as a comedic actor.
Well, I mean, Community did a lot for that as well. I mean, it was a great show. Chevy Chase was funny in it. Fine.
Now, he didn't do much for himself.
No.
He did not. He's still a jackass.
Oh, yeah. He's still a huge prick. And I still think that the funniest thing I ever heard was reading how him and Bill Murray got in a fight during some SNL thing, and Bill Murray called him a medium talent. And I thought that was the best insult I'd ever heard in my life. It's just such a slap in the face.
I want to use that on people in my life now.
Yeah.
That's good. All right. Well, with that being said, we shall leave you and let you get on with your day, your work day, your workout routine, your drive in the car, whatever might be going on, your riding of the bus, so wherever your day is taking you, we shall let you get on with it and get on with our day as well. But before we do, just one quick mention that if you have questions, comments, concerns, or problems with anything you have heard, we don't care. No. let us know. You can email us info@thearcadeshow.com or hit us up through social media. Follow us on Twitter @thearcadeshow and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/thearcadeshow. And if you haven't done so, if you haven't previously subscribed to our podcast, our free podcast on the free podcast platforms of iTunes and Google Play, you can do so by clicking the direct links to both of those pages on our homepage of thearcadeshow.com. So until next time, good night, everybody.
Good night.